We have a guest. We're talking cli-fi or client. I can't say it. Climate science fiction. Here on I Should Be Writing, episode 80, season 17.
Well, I should be writing. I should be working on my craft. I should be writing. I should be submitting my next draft. But I'm sitting home watching Doctor Who.
And hi there. Welcome to I Should Be Writing. This is the podcast for wannabe fiction writers. I'm your host, Mer Lafferty. I use she, her pronouns. I stream on Twitch twice a week at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, Tuesday, Thursday. And I think that's, I've written 5 books that are out. Started doing this podcast well before I ever got published. And I'm still doing it now because I still have things to learn. And luckily, I have someone here to help me learn, which is Sarah Leahy. Do you like that segue? Did I do good?
Money in my monkey bank.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Anyway, welcome. It is lovely to have you.
It's lovely being here. Thank you.
So we usually start the show with talking about what you've been up to. And I have been doing, unfortunately, freelance work. So I've had to prioritize some freelance stuff and not move on my NaNoWriMo novel. But, you know, after the wild 10 days or so I've had, I don't feel too bad about that. So you want to tell us what you've been working on, Sarah?
Yes. I teach, so I teach university. So that does take up a bit of my time as well. And I've just moved. I was living in Sydney, Australia. So I've just moved about 6 hours down the south coast to this beautiful farm with the idea that I would come down here and write, and, you know, many novels will be written in the next 18 months.
Yeah, a whole bunch of novels over 18 months.
It's so beautiful. It's a bit distracting. I've got really, like, giant kangaroos on my doorstep, and this sweeping vista that takes in the sort of countryside and the ocean and things like that. So it is a little bit distracting because you walk outside and you just sort of relax. And after we've had a pretty heavy lockdown in Australia with COVID, so so after that, it's just been beautiful. It's really blissful and it's freed up. I think you feel you can breathe out here, so it's lovely.
That's great. And I don't know why I just attached to this, but I'm impressed that you're already hanging things on the wall since you just moved.
Yeah, I moved about 2 weeks ago. So
wow.
Yeah, we did a pretty good pack up and set up in that time. So yeah, it's been busy but lovely.
Excellent.
And we were just talking about our dogs. So yes, I've brought my I have a working dog. Meaning the breed is that working breed.
Oh, yeah.
So, she's just loving it down here.
I bet. And you are putting off a trip to the beach with the dog for this interview. So I appreciate
all
that. That's
you.
Very kind.
All for you.
We're all very, very grateful. Before we get started, we're going to talk about good news. Like I said, my good news is I'm not going to have to go to the hospital every day and worry that much. So very happy about that. And we hit the yay button for that. When I can get the yay button working. The yay button is not working. Why is the yay button? All right. Sarah, do you have any good news to share while I try to fix the dang yay button?
Oh, all good news. Well, I suppose my book was released a couple of weeks ago. So the second book in the series. That was really good news.
That's excellent.
What other good news can I sing?
Gonna shake that money in my monkey bank.
Oh, my friend had a baby yesterday.
That's great.
Really lovely. So, yeah, that's good news.
Mm-hmm. And we will check with the chat to see if they have any good news. Let's see, we got Kids Are Asleep. Kids Are Asleep is Valerie Valdez, a streamer and amazing author as well. For today, I got my cover and got to reveal it. It's really good. That's excellent. Oh, that's a good feeling.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's so exciting.
Yes, definitely. Finally got my car back from the shop. Yay for working car. Excellent. Under Pope has reached the 100th submission, and I don't have a freaking yay button? What? It's just, Underpope, that's fantastic. Underpope's been working on shooting for 100 submissions this year and just made it. Congratulations.
Fantastic. Yay.
Yay. Yes, exact. Thank you, Numbers Ninja. Just this changing of things. Maybe I'm just getting confetti going. Can I get the confetti going? Yes, there we go. I got the confetti. We will be happy with the confetti. Congratulations, Under Pope. Congratulations on your move and everything, Sarah. And the car and 31K on Nano. That's fantastic. Have you been doing NaNoWriMo, Sarah?
No.
Okay.
No. But I'll look into it.
Well, we're over halfway done with the month. And yeah, I haven't officially given up. Like, I don't feel the usual despair I do when I give up, but I'm pretty sure I'm not going to hit 50,000. That's pretty clear. But
big target.
Yeah, big target for 30 days.
Yeah.
New goal, 1,000. Okay, I can make it to 1,000 kids are asleep. Can we get one between 50 and 1? Somewhere in there. Real quick, want to mention our sponsor, which is Scribophile. You can go to scribophile.com and make... That's where you can go to meet communities, beta readers, writing critique partners. It's a lonely business we do here, and Scribophile is where you can find other people to help you out. Because that is one of the biggest things people talk about. One of the biggest things they ask me, especially now during pandemic times... How do I find a writing group to help me improve my fiction? So Scribophile.com is the place for that. And thank you for your support, Scribophile. And let's get on to our interview. Sarah, tell us about this book and how Cli-Fi came to be.
Okay, well, Cli-Fi is this new science fiction genre that has sort of just started bubbling away in the background, and then all of a sudden, I think, with the interest in climate change that's happened over the last couple of years, it's really boomed. So I teach a subject called design technologies to university students or emerging design technologies, and we create a thought experiment whereby I say to the students, what would the world be like if you went to sleep tonight and woke up one generation, so 30 years ahead in the future? What will our cities and our buildings be like? How will climate change have affected the way we live? And we've been doing that for a couple of years, and I thought this is a really interesting topic because I've got kids in their, you know, early 20s, mid-20s, and I wanted to pose that question and, you know, story and see what the world would be like. So writing's in my family. My parents are journalists and my friends are journalists, and I've always liked to write. So I've written a few sort of pretty ordinary novels several years ago, but this one was it just took off. I really loved writing it, and it's about a climate scientist who is working on a climate model that can predict the future of weather. But in the book, the novel is set in 2050, people are over climate change. They don't want to talk about it anymore. They don't want to invest in it. They don't want to read about it. The planet is heating up and sea levels have risen. And this is her journey through a sort of bit of an adventure. And there's a bit of an evil tech company, and there's sort of a time travel plot that's sort of woven into it as well. And so the first book, Gravity is Heartless, was released last year, and it set the main character, her name is Quinn, off on this huge adventure that she travels around the world, and she goes to climate cities. And in the final book, which is Nostalgia is Heartless, she ends up in Antarctica, which is the climax of the book, without giving too much away. There's an adventure romance in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And she meets some really quirky, wonderful characters that help her on her journey.
How have you found response to the series and the climate science fiction?
Yeah, it's been terrific. So the first book has won, it won the Gold Independent Publisher Award this year. It won the American Writers Science Fiction Award. It was shortlisted in Reader's Favourite, and then I think it was Best Book Awards as well. It won, or finalist, sorry, in science fiction. And it's also received a couple of finalists for LGBTQ. It has gender-neutral characters, and it has gay characters as well. So that's been fantastic. And the university I work for has picked up on that as well, because we're, you know, trying to be as inclusive as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really driven, I suppose, a trend towards that category in sales as well.
Mm-hmm.
Second book was released just the beginning of this month. And so that's just really starting to take off at the same time as well. So it's been great. It's been really wonderful.
That's great.
Wonderful reviews and really lovely sort of starting to get a good science fiction following as well, which is terrific.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. When someone writes to you out of the blue, you know, they go onto your website and they take the time to send you an email saying, I just read your book and I love it. It's really good.
Yeah.
Thank you. And it's just such a thrill, you know, even if it's just one person every so often, it's lovely. It's lovely to connect with people in that way. And when someone really understands what you're doing or gets the point of it, then it makes it all worthwhile, because it does take a long time to write books. And you are often, you know, doing this alone in a solitary room, typing away at your computer, thinking, you know, what am I doing? Is this worth it? You know, creative pursuits take up a lot of time, particularly the creative pursuit of writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does. Do you have a trilogy in mind, or are you going to keep going with the series, or how's that going to work?
I just love writing, so I could write forever, and I have lots and lots and lots of ideas. So I have book 3 and 4 planned.
Wow.
3's underway. It's about half written, and it's sort of set one generation ahead. So books 1 and 2 were set in 2050 in the world sort of ravaged by climate change. But there's an optimistic outlook. Things are just starting to change. We're just starting to get on top of the carbon emissions, and in book 2 they're starting to drop, so there is that optimistic edge that science can save us. And in book 3 it's set on the moon.
Ooh.
So I really wanted to write about off-world habitation and, you know, what it would be like to actually build a community on the moon and how that would work and how people would live, but with a kind of a romance happening as well, so a sort of an adventure romance happening with the characters as well. I just love, you know, I just love characters that fall in love and have all that angst and feel lonely and all those human emotions and get angry and don't really understand why. And so I like to have those side plots where, you know, there is a romance happening as well.
Yeah. No, that's good. I think it makes books better when there's more stuff to think about and more conflict, you know? Throwing in a relationship just throws in another opportunity for conflict, sometimes more than one.
Yeah, that's so true, Mo. Absolutely. You know, you've got to have that internal conflict happening inside the characters where they grow and they understand, as well as all the external stuff that you put on them that they need to navigate through.
Right. So one thing that's always impresses me about scientists and more science-minded science fiction writers than I am is the futurist sort of role that some people take on. And it's a weird question, because I'm terrible at predicting things. I'm awful at it. I was at a game company in 1995 or six, somewhere around there. And a game company that was just about to release a game that would be a huge hit and still have things released today. And I thought it was the stupidest idea I've ever heard. So really, I am not in the prediction game. So how do you get to from here to, you know, figuring out what happens, cause and effect will matter? That's the weirdest question, but
no, it's a really good question. I think I have worked as an interior designer for 30 years, and part of that I was working as color predicting. So I love color, and
color predicting what,
yeah, so looking at what colors would be popular in design.
Oh, yes. Ahead.
So we used to have these little forums where we would look at what color trends had happened previously and what material color pattern trends were popular now, and then how that would progress into the future, because, you know, obviously manufacturers and marketing people need to know this. You know, if you can predict something, you can be ahead, and it's very advantageous. So I sort of took that background to science, and my books are categorized as high tech. So they do have a lot of science or hard science in them. And it just takes a lot of research. It takes an incredible amount of research to start to think about what products and what technologies will be popular, particularly communication technologies, and how they will advance into the future. So part of it is, I suppose, research, and part of it is common sense, because some technologies are stupid while others are fabulous, you know. And I think there'll be huge breakthroughs in things like medicine and products and medical science. So that's sort of easy to implement. And then it's just a really sort of considered guess of what other technologies and products will lead us, you know, into the mid-21st century. I think both books take a lighthearted look at our relationship with technology. Mm-hmm. And a lot of technologies in the book don't work. You know, so you'll try to do something and then it just won't work. And, you know, it's the characters sort of discuss, well, what will we do now? Let's just turn it on and off. That's always worked before. So there is that connection with technology whereby it's, some people are taking it up and implanting it in their bodies, you know, so it's transhuman type characters, whereas other characters don't want anything to do with technology whatsoever, and sort of call those characters humanists, whereby they are, they feel they are very connected to the planet, to Earth, and they won't leave it. They believe that they are, you know, connected to every rock, tree, lake and river. And so there's that divide between those characters who feel they are really connected to Earth, the humanists, and the transhumans who want to leave the planet and start a new community somewhere else, you know, in the universe, because the planet is sort of starting to die. So, yeah, it's a really interesting question. And, yeah, I think people are divided on that, about where they stand with their connection to technologies. And I've sort of tried to explain that a little bit in the book without being too technical.
Right. Yeah, that's always a challenge. You know, there are some people out there who love every little detail of every crunchy science fact you dug up. And for every one of those, there's someone who's just like, please, can you just show me a character? Get to a story. I don't care about anything yet. I just do not need to know how the FTL works.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true, yeah.
I'm sorry, can we go back to the color prediction thing? Because I really, that's fascinating. It reminds me of, have you read Bellwether by Connie Willis?
No, I haven't.
It is social science fiction. And it's about a woman who's trying to study trends and figure out where trends begin. And it's just, it's a delightful novella because it's, I could not think of a social science fiction kind of thing, and Connie Willis just does it. So that's what the color prediction reminded me of, which is the bellwether research this woman's doing. Also, there are sheep involved.
I'm just writing this down right now.
Oh, good.
That sounds fascinating. Love social issues.
Yeah. Can you tell us kind of how you do the color predictions? I just sort of thought there were some people in a room who just decided that, you know, dark teal is in this year kind of thing.
So what we do is we look at the color trends and predictions that have come previously, and so over the past sort of couple of decades. Then we put together some research groups and, you know, talk about colour in general and what they like and what they don't like. Then we look at, we take about sort of half a dozen topics, I suppose, and we look at visually how they've been portrayed. So we might look at, you know, major sporting events. We might look at the current trends in music, art, and literature, I suppose. We look at the best-selling items, so whether that be book covers or products, and we look, you know, at all this sort of visual material that we're being bombarded with all the time, and, you know, particularly fashion as well, because a lot of colour trends come from fashion. It's a huge industry, and we kind of gauge whether they're going to filter down into design as well. So part of the core group that we're sort of pitching to are textile manufacturers as well. So they're quite interested in where we think those colour trends will go. So we take all this information, and it's always just a considered guess to see if there are any obvious pop colours. So, you know, obvious, that fabulous scene from, oh, what's that movie, The Devil Wears Prada, mm-hmm. where you've got Meryl Streep in that room and Emily Blunt and, oh, I can't remember the other character, but they start discussing colours, and then you've got cerulean that comes in. And so we try and identify any pop colours, whether they're warm colours or whether they're cool colours. We look at the environment as well in terms of nature and what colours have come previously, and then try and just identify any trends that are coming through, whether, you know, hot pink hasn't been used in a while and whether it's going to be really bright or whether it's going to be pared back, whether pastels are looking to trend. And I think it's really related to the mood of, well, I can't say the planet, but the mood of people. You know, so in a pandemic, people will probably start to look at softer colours because we're spending more time at home. Hmm. We need more nurturing colours. And then coming out of this environment, we're probably looking at fresher colours as well. You know, more greens and blues and these types of colours will start to become a little bit more popular. So it's always a considered guess, but hopefully it's considered enough to be accurate.
Yeah. That is fascinating. So is there anybody in this people who study this who are just like, that is a horrible, horrible color, and I'm going to try to turn the tide against it? Or is it just watching and studying, not influencing?
Oh, that's a really good question. I suppose you do influence without realizing sometimes, because colour is so subjective. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have colours that we love, but then there are colours that we don't like. And perhaps, you know, if you went to a school where you, in Australia, we have a school uniform where you always wore that particular green check for, you know, however many years you went to school, you're not going to like that colour. So we have those sort of subjective influences as well that come through, and it's all very personal and it's very individual. And I think the way we see colours is different as well. Some people might look at a teal, for example, and say, well, that's green. And someone else might say, no, it's blue. So I suppose you do bring, of course, your own influences to everything you do, and you can inadvertently maybe pitch a colour that you love or a colour that you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some colours that are a bit, you know, unpleasant sometimes, but you can, you know, sort of browns and depressing colours or greys that might feel really cold. But I think you can put them with other things. You know, it is all about mixing and matching and creating not just one colour, but a palette of colours that work well with different materials, particularly natural materials.
So as we can see on the stream, and you can go look at the show notes if you're listening to this later, Nostalgia's Heartless has a gorgeous purple and blue cover, sort of aurora borealis in the sky, and the ice is very blue, and Gravity is Heartless, the first book, is very blue-green, and they're eye-catching. These aren't typical science fiction books. These are really
big.
Yeah, they're gorgeous in a different way. So you having this expertise of a that I have never heard of anybody having, you know someone's got to have that expertise, but you never know if you'll actually meet somebody who can tell us all the awesome things that you just did. But with your expertise, did you have any say, or did you want to do any guidance on the cover? Because usually authors don't get that.
Yeah, no, the first cover I sketched up, She Writes Press, fabulous publisher, they wanted, you know, we want the vision of, out of your head. So I sent them sort of photos and things that I thought would work, which they quickly said, no, we want you. I mean, no, this is fantastic. I think this is going to work really well on the cover. And they just dismissed everything. And they said, no, we want the vision that's inside your head. And so we want you to sketch it. So I sent just through a series of sketches, and they put that together. Ben Perini did the cover of both books from the sketches. And then, yeah, we just introduced the colours, and I basically sort of said, you know, a little bit bright and not so bright, that type of thing, in the proofs. And they both look great. I love them. I think he's done an amazing job. Yeah, Gravity is Heartless has got that. That's the climate city on the front, so it's described as a bit of a hanging garden of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gated city where only the privileged can go or live, and it's a city with cool air, whereas most of the population are living in a metropolis of, you know, 100 million people who are very hot and very weary and very frustrated with their lives, whereas, you know, there's this divide between... Well, the economic divide has now become between cool air and warm air. And then the cover for Nostalgia is the Ice Cube neutrino station in Antarctica, and it's got the aurora borealis behind it. And the ice is so blue because old ice looks much bluer than new ice. We've lost all the new ice. New ice being white when the light hits it, it just immediately refracts. So it's reflected off the ice, whereas the older ice is more compact and the light sort of can't get into it. So it looks much bluer.
Wow.
So this will happen probably. You know, the world will start to look quite different with climate change. Our oceans, the colour of our oceans will change, depending on the plankton in them, and the ice will look much bluer.
Wow.
As the new ice melts and we're left with this really compacted ancient ice.
All right, well, now I'm sad. Oh boy.
Science will save us. We're going to be fine.
Yes, science will explain all the bad, and then hopefully But you said...
But we need to act now. We really do need to act now.
Yes, definitely. I know I went on a big color tangent, but I just loved hearing you talk about that. Is there anything you want to talk about regarding your book or writing that I have not brought up?
Oh, I suppose we could talk a little bit about you know, writing and mm-hmm. a creative life, because I think everybody should have something. I think we're creative creatures, humans, and we need to tell stories and express ourselves in a creative way. I think this is really important for our mental health and for who we are. And I think we should all, whether that be music or art or literature, explore that and do more things with our hands. Because as a teacher, you know, I get students to sketch. And even if they don't like sketching, I say, no, you've got to, you know, move away from a laptop and do something with your hands and create something. And I think writing as a creative pursuit is wonderful. To be able to tell your stories and get them out of your head and onto paper or onto the laptop, those types of things. But it's a very long pursuit.
Yeah.
And sometimes people sort of ask me, you know, what's your best tip? And I say, you know, don't give up your day job, because you may not ever make it big. You've got to enjoy what you do and enjoy the journey along the way.
Yeah.
You just decide to live that creative life and plug away at it. Write for yourself, write for your family, write for your fans, and enjoy it along the way.
Yeah, I once broke down in a blog post explaining how you could make more money working at McDonald's than having a $100,000 trilogy book deal.
Yeah,
it's depressing, but you know, it's not, here's a check for 100K, it's here's a part of the first book, and then you got to do a lot of work, and then here's a part of the second book, etc. So I love that you moved to a small cottage. Is it helping your writing? Because a lot of people say if they could only have that one thing, they could write. But I'm a little skeptical, thinking if you're not writing now, you're not going to write when you have whatever this cottage is going to give you. But you sound like you're really thriving.
Yeah, I will be. I've just had a few visitors, so they need to go home. As much as I love them. They do. I will be. It is absolutely. It's the, while I'm still working down here, I'm working online and I still teach online.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely that solitary time whereby you give yourself that you need to write. So it will be very productive.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, for me, writing is, you know, I tend to do a stint for a few hours, but then you need to walk away and, you know, have those light bulb moments of creativity where you do walk away, or you go for a walk with the dog, or, you know, I walk through the farm and walk to the beach. And that's where, in the gaps, that's where the ideas come. I used to take a notepad. Now I have a audio recording, so I'll just make notes onto my phone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a, you know, it's a balance between those two things of being really productive writing, but then also giving yourself those big windows to let ideas come in.
Right. Yeah, the doing the hyper-focus thing and writing like 3,000 and 4,000 words at one sitting will usually leave me drained and unable to think anything complex the day after, and I have to remember it does need to be just a couple of hours, and then you move on to something that's not writing, that so your brain can rest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it can be really intense, absolutely, and yeah, I think, you know, you've got to try and balance that between, you know, what you're doing and life and all those other things that sort of get in the way. Yeah, but it is, I'm in a really, really beautiful spot. I was living in the pandemic in Sydney. My partner said to me, you know, come and live with me. And so we moved into a small apartment with this working dog, Kelpie, Australian working dog, who needs a lot of exercise. And was there for about a year, and we just went, this is not working. We're just going crazy. So I've rented this cottage. It's actually the maid's quarters of this old homestead. and it's on, you know, a hill that's overlooking a valley and the ocean, and it's very, very beautiful. I just got down here and thought, I can breathe again. It's really just opened things up and feel so much better mentally than being in the city. So it's, I'm very lucky.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's great to hear.
And my kids are sort of like, you've run away, you've run away. And I was saying, no, I haven't run away, but I think I have. I think I did actually run away.
I don't know. You know, if you're like, you're doing your job, you raise kids, you know, it sounds like you're allowed to run away a little bit. Doesn't seem like you're leaving much behind that is responsibility focused.
Look, that's absolutely true. I mean, I'll be 60 next year, and I've been a single parent for a couple of decades. And I just thought they've all moved out of home and they're all in jobs and you know, doing great. And I just thought, oh, this is my time. I've never lived alone. I need to just escape and do some writing for myself.
As Kids Are Asleep says, running towards new thing, not running away from old ones.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I'll use that.
Excellent. So what do you have on deck next? Are you just going to keep with this series, or do you have any thoughts about what you're going to do after it's complete?
I'm just going to keep with this series. I'm also thinking about a memoir, probably. You know, when you get to 60, you've lived some life, things have happened. So I might do that after, you know, a couple more books. I've got so many ideas.
So
you move down here and you think, oh, I could write a story about a woman that moves to a little cottage in the country, and this could be a mystery thriller. So lots and lots of ideas. I will stick with the series for another couple of books because I've already laid out the drafts. And I'm thinking of starting a newsletter as well. So we'll see what happens.
Well, excellent. I think we're going to shut the main part of the podcast down now. So it will sound like we're ending, but to you live here with us, we're going to keep talking with Sarah for a little bit. But where can we find you online, Sarah?
You can find me online at sarahlay.com. So
and that's
Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, Lay, L-A-H-E-Y,
right.
.com.
And the link will be in our show notes. And you can find my stuff at merverse.com. And you can support the show via Patreon, patreon.com/mightymer. Or you can watch us on Twitch twice a week, Tuesday, Thursday, 3 p.m. And I need to write out this goodbye text because I know I always forget something. But if you go to my website, you'll find out what I do. I do a lot of crap. So anyway, we will see you next time. And until then, you should be writing. I Should Be Writing is available to you under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Theme music by John Anilio. Art by Numbers Ninja. Production by Summer Brooks. And hosting by Libsyn. Find all of this information and more at merverse.com. And remember, we can't do this without you. Thanks for your support. Doctor Who. I'm sitting home watching Doctor Who.